Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With Bolivian President Evo Morales' plane from Moscow diverted to Austria on suspicion that Edward Snowden is aboard, and France and Portugal refusing to allow the Bolivian-bound flight to cross their airspace, we'll begin with a prominent human rights lawyer who has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us. We'll discuss the latest twists and turns in the Edward Snowden case and the extent to which WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange now appears to speak for him. Then we will speak with a former KGB general, Oleg Kalugin, who was a longtime head of KGB operations in the United States and later a critic of the KGB and Vladimir Putin. He joins us to discuss what effect the Snowden case has had on U.S.-Russian relations and why Putin appears to be more interested in working with the Obama administration than against it, as Russia's oil-dependent economy slows and the need for Western investment in Russia's energy sector grows. Then finally, Dr. Ian Lipkin, the director of the Center of Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, joins us. He is working with an international team of scientists investigating a deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. We will discuss the outbreak in Saudi Arabia and whether MERS could be spread worldwide following the upcoming annual pilgrimage to Mecca by millions of Muslims from around the world. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Scott, it seems that when the president on his trip to Africa recently tried to downplay the significance of Edward Snowden and sort of suggested it wasn't a big deal, he said, "I'm not going to, scramble the jets to get a 29-year-old hacker." Well, it looks like that's exactly what he has done. I mean, the assumption would be that the United States told the French and the Portuguese to close their airspace to the presidential jet belonging to Evo Morales of Bolivia, who was leaving Moscow, where he had been attending this energy conference that Putin had put on, along with the head of Venezuela, Maduro, was at the same conference. Apparently, from my understanding, and this is sort of a breaking news story at the moment, so we're not quite clear of the details. The plane it's a Falcon jet, so it's a small jet. It was forced to land in Spain and then diverted to Austria, where it's on the runway in Vienna as we speak. So do you have any more clarity on this?
Nothing beyond what you've just said, although I have to say these events are absolutely extraordinary, and I think you're right to juxtapose this with the remarks that Obama made in Africa. I mean, we know by way of background, of course, that the Department of Defense prepared a strategy for dealing with important national security leaks. And we know right up front in the beginning of that strategy paper was the suggestion that you make the leaker into a target and you launch a massive campaign of vilification targeting the leaker. And in part, that is designed to distract public attention from the leak and focus everything instead on the person of the leaker. And I think we've seen that played out in the United States and the U.S. media in particular, the way the government has managed it. And I think here we see some what appears to be absolutely extraordinary conduct by the U.S. government, because it's simply inconceivable that France and Portugal would shut off their airspace and that a plane carrying a head of state from a summit meeting would be forced to land unless the United States had intervened aggressively and forcefully with the governments involved, bringing tremendous pressure to bear on them to act in this way. So certainly the conduct is a violation of international protocols and agreements that respect the rights of heads of state. and travel. So it's really remarkable.
And the foreign minister of Bolivia is saying it's all a lie. We don't know who invented this lie. And that the decision by France and Portugal put at risk the life of the president. So the fact of the plane is at the airport in Vienna, and you know, it's at this point, I don't know that they've gone aboard the plane. I don't know whether they can, whether it's the, you know, considered.
Well, diplomatic protocols on this point are completely clear, and that is that that aircraft carrying a head of state would be diplomatically inviolable. They would not be entitled to board it and seize people who are on without the permission of the president of Bolivia. It would be his call entirely. Of course, if it turns out that Snowden is not on board that flight, this is going to be a hugely embarrassing development for the United States and for the other governments that acted on the U.S., what we presume is a U.S. request.
Well, that's where we are now, and I'm hoping that we're looking at the wires here, at least the producers are, to find out what the latest is, because if they can't go on the plane to find out whether Snowden's on the plane, I don't know what the standoff's about. I mean, it should be established one way or the other whether he's on the plane. At this point, based upon what the Bolivians are saying, they're saying it's all a lie. So it may well be that the U.S. ends up being incredibly embarrassed. So not only are they looking like a bully, they're looking like a stupid bully.
That's right. And, you know, where does the rumor come from? Well, we know that earlier today, President Morales, in fact, gave an interview to Russia Today in which he talked about Snowden and said that he would be welcome in his country. And we know that some American reporters instantly began to focus on the fact that he was in Moscow at that point and that maybe Snowden would accompany him home. So there was speculation launched in the U.S. media immediately after his remarks.
So
one would hope certainly that there would be more than this sort of wild speculation that would have driven extreme action like this.
Well, Scott Horton, again, professor at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, and he has also represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Snowden, earlier, before this incident took place, he withdrew his asylum request to Russia, presumably based upon the remarks that, in fact, indeed, and based upon the remarks that Putin made yesterday, saying that he could stay in Russia, but he had to stop leaking information damaging to our American partners, as strange as that may sound coming from my lips, I'm quoting Putin. So what do you think happened to Snowden there? Because it's basically, and now we don't know where he is, and there's about 19 other countries he's asked for, and almost all of them have said no, except for Venezuela and Bolivia.
I'd say this has been remarkably ill-managed by Snowden. He left Hawaii, he landed in Hong Kong, and then the disclosures started in The Guardian, and then when the U.S. put out an apprehension request to the Hong Kong authorities, the Hong Kong authorities basically opened up an opportunity for him to leave immediately and helped him onto a flight to go to Russia. But if Snowden had been taking care of himself first, he would have, before any publications occurred, he would have secured a right of asylum somewhere, and he would have done that very, very quietly and would have gone to the place where he was requesting asylum and established it. And that would have happened before the disclosures got launched. So I think he's really painted himself into a corner with his rather compulsive and high-risk activities.
Well, it seems like the leader of Ecuador he's of course sheltering at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, Julian Assange. He is obviously irritated with Assange, who appeared on American television on ABC on Sunday morning, saying that that Joe Biden in his phone call to Correa had had bullied him, and Correa went public and said, "No, well, Snowden doesn't know what he's, I mean, Assange doesn't know what he's talking about. I had a cordial conversation with Vice President Biden, and nobody, you know, bullies us, you know, in Ecuador. We don't take those kind of phone calls." And he's also indicated he was irritated with Assange about getting Ecuadorian documents for Snowden to travel from Hong Kong with this WikiLeaks minder he's traveling with. So what's going on there between Correa his guest, Assange?
Well, I think Julian Assange violated the first rule of asylum, and that is that you don't embarrass or undercut your host. You have to be very, very careful in how you deal with a government that decides to accord you asylum, and you certainly don't want to publicly embarrass them, and that's exactly what Julian Assange did here. And I have to say it's odd, because I increasingly get the sense that that all of these matters surrounding Snowden are simply being stage managed by Julian Assange and his WikiLeaks organization. In fact, I look at the statement that Snowden put out just yesterday from Moscow, and this statement doesn't look like any of the prior remarks that were made by Snowden, but it looks exactly like a series of statements that have been previously made by Assange. So I'm really beginning to get the sense that Assange is speaking on his behalf now.
Well, Assange, of course, is the subject of a documentary by Alex Gibney that a lot of supporters of WikiLeaks are outraged by. But my understanding is that Gibney started out very sympathetic to Assange and wanted to basically make an homage to him, and ended up making a very critical film simply because of his experience dealing with Assange and others that I know who've made had dealings with him as well have come away with the same problem. So one always has to make a distinction between the message and the messenger. And so much of the time, you know, people trash the messenger and forget about the message. And that's what they're doing to Glenn Greenwald at the moment.
Well, I would strongly advise your listeners to take the time to see that film that Alex Gibney did, We Steal Secrets. I think it's a brilliant piece. I don't think it's a hit job at all. I do think it adopts a critical, balanced attitude towards Julian Assange and Bradley Manning and others. And I think Alex Gibney is sharply critical of the national security state and its excesses. He's sharply critical of the surveillance practices of the NSA, and he's very supportive of whistleblowers. Indeed, as a documentary filmmaker, his work has turned very heavily on cooperation with whistleblowers. I don't think he would have been able to do much of his work, including the Oscar award-winning film Taxi to the Dark Side, without whistleblowers. But he also believes that you have to have some balance, that a whistleblower, as we use that term, refers to someone who is disclosing a secret because he believes it contains information about criminal activity, fraud, abuse, or other wrongdoing, or corrupt or incompetent acts by a government actor that otherwise would not be properly investigated and addressed. That's what we call whistleblowing. And I think what we see with Assange and WikiLeaks and also Bradley Manning is that the sort of balancing and filtering that really are essential to legitimate whistleblowing isn't going on. Instead, it's just wholesale disclosure of a state's darkest secrets for purposes of embarrassing the state. That's not whistleblowing. And I think when we come to cases like Edward Snowden, I mean, it's still not clear in my mind where he stands on this divide. I mean, I from his statements about his intention, he clearly puts himself in the camp of whistleblowers. And I have to say, looking at a lot of the materials that have been disclosed so far, I think they are legitimately covered as whistleblower disclosures. But there's more to come, and I'm a little bit anxious about the way it's being handled and how it's being presented.
Well, Glenn Greenwald said on Fox News that there was going to be some real shockers coming in the future. So it seems like it's going to be sort of drip, drip, drip here. The other point being, we still don't know whether he is on this plane or not that the president of Bolivia has left Moscow on and has been diverted and. The Bolivians are outraged, and if it turns out that they are correct in saying that he's not on the plane, it's a huge lie, then whoever perpetrated this clumsy effort, this Keystone Cop effort, and muscled in on the French and the Portuguese to refuse the overflight of this plane, this is not going to play well in Latin America. This reinforces all of the sense that the U.S. is the global bully.
I think that's right. I mean, I think even if he is on the plane, it looks very heavy-handed and ridiculous. And, you know, and I have to say, I think the remarks that Obama made in Africa were correct. I mean, the U.S. shouldn't be playing it up to the media and engaging in, you know, swashbuckling international.
Right, or wheeling and dealing, as he said,
I mean, they should be using the normal, lawful processes to seek his extradition. And you got to keep in mind that what he's done is absolutely, these are political crimes. And there are dozens of people every year who disclose the secrets of the intelligence services of their country and seek asylum in other countries. In fact, the U.S. has given asylum to such people since the middle of the 19th century. And I know of several cases where it's extended asylum this very year. So that's a completely normal process. And the government on the other side has to use its, you know, political clout and arts of persuasion to get them to turn an assailant over. But normally that would only happen if the assailant agrees to return. That's what the U.S. should be focused on. So this is really, I'm afraid, sending exactly the wrong signal.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great pleasure to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. In fact, there's an article about Scott Horton in the current issue of The New Yorker called Buried Secrets. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined by a former KGB general.
Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're watching me on the telly. See me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Oleg Kalugin, who's a former KGB general. He was a longtime head of KGB operations in the United States and later a critic of the intelligence agency. In 2002, he's put on trial in absentia in Moscow and found guilty of spying for the West. He was sentenced to 15 years in jail, but the United States has refused to extradite him. General Kalugin currently works for the CI Center, a counterintelligence consulting and training firm in the Washington, D.C. area, and he's also an advisory director of the International Spy Museum. He remains a critic of Vladimir Putin, whom he called a war criminal. He is the author of a number of books, including Spymaster, My 32 Years in Intelligence and Espionage Against the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Oleg Kalugin.
Thank you for the introduction.
So what do you make of what's going on in Moscow now with Edward Snowden, who's been in this no man's land in Moscow airport, where there's a division of opinion over whether or not the material he has with him on laptops and in thumb drives has already been compromised, perhaps already in the hands of Chinese intelligence and in the hands of the SVR, the successor agency to the KGB, given that they have a lot of access and influence in that particular part of the airport. So let's begin with that part of the airport. What do you know about the security services and their relationship to that area of the airport?
Well, it's a strictly guarded area, often from the old Soviet days, not so much because of foreigners arriving to Moscow, but for the Russians who tried to attempt to leave Moscow for abroad. So it has both ways, as a security, counterintelligence, well, and occasionally debriefing of new passengers if they look suspicious or, you know, their documents look, sort of faked or something, you know. So this is a major clearance area for security reasons. The fact that Snowden was held there for a while is understandable, the more so that he could not really explain what he wants a transit to or stay in Russia. And this is number one. The other very important part of this problem is that President Putin and the current Russian government does not want to quarrel with the United States over such a minor issue. There are other problems both nations, I mean, actually Russia and the United States and European nations are facing today. And, like in the Middle East, for instance, the Syrian crisis, where Russia is fully behind the current Syrian regime while, you know, the rebels and the Western countries support the different nature of the regime. So there are a lot of other things. And Snowden was a major distraction, and Russians do not want to deal with it. The sooner he gets out of the country, the better.
Well, yesterday he applied for, on Sunday, I should say, Snowden applied for asylum in Russia. And then Vladimir Putin did a press conference where he said that Snowden was welcome to stay in Russia, but he had to stop leaking secrets and damaging our American partner. And then Putin went on to say, as strange as it may sound coming from my lips. So is Putin being disingenuous here? On the one hand, he's saying we don't want to upset the Americans, but on the other hand, maybe they've gotten all they want out of Snowden already.
I think that Putin is quite open and honest in his statement. He doesn't want to spoil the relationship with the United States over this, misfit, let's put it this way, a guy who doesn't know what he really wants. He doesn't want to work for the agency he used to work for. And he has applied, I understand, for exit to any countries. But Russia would not want to, quarrel with the United States over this issue. They will better expel him and let him go wherever he wants to. He does not present any interest to Russian intelligence and security at this time.
Is that because they already have access to everything that he has with him? Because prior to leaving his job at Booz Allen, he apparently went around because he had access to all the computers, because he was the IT guy, according to both what he said and what others have said in terms of damage control, that he did sort of take a bunch of secrets. He sort of cherry-picked the stuff that he thought was the most important, and he has that with him. So when you say the Russians don't want anything more to do with him, does that mean that they already have all of the secrets, as is alleged that the Chinese have?
Well, that's probably number one. The other thing is they do not want, to spoil the relationship with the current U.S. administration because of this, episode. There are more important things to resolve and look at and try to solve together. So why should they take care of this misfit, as I call him?
Well, already, you know, he has withdrawn his application to stay in Russia following the statements made by Putin.
Putin was very negative in that sense, right?
Yeah, he's decided that he did not want to agree that, to the conditions of not speaking out further about what it is that he has with him. So there's also a meeting going on at the moment in Moscow, some of the oil-producing countries, and Venezuela, their president is present in Moscow. There's some speculation.
Oh, yeah, he is leaving today, yes, on the 2nd, I believe.
Right. He did say, Maduro did say that he's not going to take Snowden back on the presidential plane, as some people had suggested. So as far as we know, unless you know something else, General Kalugin, that Snowden is still in no man's land there.
Still at the international section of the Russian Moscow airport,
right.
As I understand. He hasn't left the area, not yet as far as I know.
Right.
But things are changing fast. And the fact that Venezuela, I thought that he would find a more sort of warm welcome in Venezuela, his final destination. But, at the moment, I haven't seen any public statements by the Venezuelan leader. And he is in Moscow, I say, till the 2nd. Yeah, that's right.
So what do you think has changed then in terms of the U.S. And Russian relationship? It's been fairly prickly for some time now, particularly following the Majitsky affair and the Congress passing that law, the Majitsky law, because of this whistleblower who tried to go public about government officials stealing some $200 million. And then instead of the government officials being put on trial, Majitsky himself was thrown in jail, and he subsequently died of ill treatment in jail. And the U.S. is rather like they did during the Cold War with the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, have put in this human rights amendment, which has angered Putin. So what's brought about Putin's change of heart vis-a-vis the United States?
Well, I think Putin is just looking forward. There were lots of things in Cold War time and the leftovers, the traditions of the Cold War mentality are still alive. And though Putin does not belong to the progressive part of of Russia's, sort of more radical reformers, he knows the rules of the game. And why should he quarrel with the United States over this specific and really unimportant issue for the bilateral relations? You know, better get rid of him. Let him leave the country. And, you know, that's the message I see from Putin.
But is Putin, for example, I mean, there are a couple of things coming up. There's the visit to Russia by President Obama in September.
That's correct. That's right. And he doesn't want to spoil the relationship. But there are more important events in the world where Russia and the United States must, should, and will collaborate. And to just make them worse on the eve of this meeting of the heads of the states, Russia and the United States, and this is right in September. And it's just makes no sense at all. And I think Putin is very, just quite wise.
Right.
I support his position.
Well, that's pretty unusual for you to support Putin, isn't it?
Well, I support what, in my view, coincides with, you know, my mentality and my knowledge and my experience. So sometimes there are things why Putin used to be my subordinate some time ago, but that was, something. Things happen in life.
But Putin was a very minor figure in the KGB.
He never was. Actually, it was President Yeltsin's idea to just promote and make some, But Putin helped Yeltsin in his family troubles, and that's why Yeltsin was grateful to Putin, and he just promoted him. Well, as a matter of fact, at some later period of his life, Yeltsin was asked a question, and it was published You will probably never find it again on the website, but I have a clipping from the Russian newspapers at the time. He was interviewed a few months before he passed away, and among other questions he was asked, well, Mr. President Yeltsin, as you look back at your life, what major errors or judgments or mistakes you made which you regret mostly? And he said, oh, I had so many. Could you name a few? I said, okay, the war in Chechnya, number one. The choice of my successor, number two. That I quote Yeltsin.
Mm. Well, of course, a lot of people have thought of Putin in terms of turning the clock back. And, of course, lately he has passed all kinds of laws to make it difficult to even criticize him. You know, these young women are in jail, the group Pussy Riot, for insulting the president.
Well, actually, Putin was insulted, but Putin also took advantage of the real, you know, mischief behavior of these ladies who started dancing on the church, in the church, I mean, by violating, well,
right,
emotional and religious and total respect for millions of Russians. And that was used as a excuse or pretext to put them in jail.
Right.
So it was not a criticism of Putin. At least no one would admit that, though. Of course, they were critical.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Oleg Kalugin, a former KGB general. He was a longtime head of KGB operations in the United States and later became a critic of the KGB. In 2002, he was put on trial in absentia in Moscow and found guilty of spying for the West. He was sentenced to 15 years in jail, but the United States has refused to extradite him. And General Kalugin currently works for the CI Center, a counterintelligence consulting and training firm in the Washington, D.C. area. And he's also an advisory director of the International Spy Museum. He remains a critic of Vladimir Putin, whom he called a war criminal, and he is the author of a number of books, including Spymaster, My 32 Years in Intelligence and Espionage Against the West. Now, Putin, of course, his popularity, as you mentioned, he is popular with the narod, as they call them, the wide, broad public, particularly out of Moscow, and not the intelligentsia by any means. His popularity, though, analysts say, rests upon economic development, which is largely predicated upon the energy sector. And because of the lack of investment and poor practices in the energy sector, there is now a need for foreign investment, my understanding, in the energy sector in order to keep the money coming in. So is Putin forced to turn to the West? And will that mean that business practices have to improve? And perhaps Mikhail Khodorkovsky, his case has to be revisited?
Well, I don't believe, though I'm totally in disagreement over Khodorkovsky. Look, there was an amnesty in Russia for people who had committed economic crimes. Khodorkovsky was not released. It was obvious from the beginning that he was put in jail not because he committed some economic crime, because he was the guy who challenged Putin at some moment, and he was removed from the political scene. And this is one of the more reasonable in terms of the people approach to political dissidents. Find something which they could be accused of: stealing money, having illegal banking accounts in the West, or something else. We have a couple of famous cases like Boris Berezovsky, for instance, who was not only a supporter, he was the guy who stood behind Mr. Putin at some point. But he miscalculated that, as you know. The other guy who lives in London, he seems to be repentant and, well, sort of willing to return to Russia. Abramovich, another Russian billionaire who made money on Russian. But this is part of really Russian dependence on raw materials and oils, energy sources. And Mr. Putin and Mr. Medvedev, who is the current prime minister, they have been talking about modernization for at least 15 years or so, and nothing happened. They are still talking and talking. Nothing happened.
Well, Oleg Kalugin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Oleg Kalugin, the former KGB general. He was a longtime head of KGB operations in the United States and later a critic of the agency. In 2002, he was put on trial in absentia in Moscow and found guilty of spying for the West. He was sentenced to 15 years in jail, but the United States has refused to extradite him. General Kalugin currently works for the CI Center, a counterintelligence consulting and training firm in the Washington, D.C. area, and is also an advisory director of the International Spy Museum. He remains a critic of Vladimir Putin, whom he called a war criminal, and is the author of a number of books, including Spymaster, My 32 Years in Intelligence and Espionage Against the West. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a virologist who has been leading the investigation into the new Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, that could break out in Saudi Arabia.
Когда придет дождь, тот, что уйдет нас, когда уйдет день над твоей землей. Я проснусь здесь, пусть я проснусь здесь, в долгой траве, рядом с тобой.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Ian Lipkin, who's the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience in microbial discovery and outbreak response. In the 1980s, Dr. Lipkin identified AIDS-associated immunological abnormalities and was the first to use purely molecular methods to identify infectious agents and implicated West Nile virus as the cause of the encephalitis epidemic in New York in 1999. He assisted the World Health Organization and the People's Republic of China during the 2003 SARS outbreak, and his team have discovered or characterized more than 500 infectious agents. He is now working with an international team of scientists to investigate the deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ian Lipkin.
Thanks for the invitation.
And MERS is a mystery, right? Scientists do not know where it came from. It's already infected at least 77 people and killed 40 in eight countries, but it seems to be mostly centered in Saudi Arabia. Is that correct?
All of what you said is correct. We don't know the origins of the virus, but by sequencing the virus, looking at its genetic composition, it appears that it's likely to have originated in a bat. We don't know if there are intermediate steps along the way before it moved into humans.
And Hanta, does Hanta come from bats as well, or is that from...
No, Hanta, the Hanta viruses, the majority of them, although there are Hanta viruses in virtually most mammals, really come from rodents, chiefly from mice.
So, but bats don't normally interact that much with people unless you go into caves, right, or into dark places. I mean, how does it transfer? And does it only take one interaction or a few from a bat to a human, and then it's sort of off to the races, as they say?
As you said, with MERS, it's a mystery, but there are a number of different infections that are probably well known to your listeners that are associated with bats or originated in bats. You mentioned SARS earlier, rabies, Nipah virus, Hendra virus, probably Ebola, but certainly Marburg. But again, there are frequently intermediate hosts along the way. So in some instances, these proved to be pigs, as they were originally with Nipah virus in Malaysia. Sometimes there's direct transmission from bats to humans, chiefly through excreta. So that's what has been observed in Bangladesh. Sometimes rabies is transmitted directly by bite. Rabies is a good example of that. So there are examples where bats have transmitted infections directly to humans. But we don't know the origin of MERS. We suppose that it's likely to be a bat based on genetic evidence, and we can't exclude the possibility that there are intermediates between bats and humans.
And you worked on the SARS outbreak in China. That was traced to civet cats, is that right?
Well, it's a misnomer. Civet cats are really more like ferrets.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, they were tracked back to civets. But the likely origin there, too, was bats. Probably bats that were housed with civets and other small animals in wild animal markets. So as we increasingly encroach upon wildlife territory, we begin to see movement of infectious agents that have been hitherto restricted to those animals moving into human populations.
Now, for the benefit of our audience, what's a coronavirus?
It's there are many. Obviously, there are millions of different viruses. We tend to name them based upon their structure, what they look like under an electron microscope, or where they're originally discovered. So it's different than bacteria. In bacteriology, people like to name these bugs after themselves. Virologists don't do that. So it's called a coronavirus because under an electron microscope, it looks like a crown. It looks like a sphere with these little budding components that come off of it that really could do look. I mean, it's an apt name for it. It really does look like a corona around the virus. So, and that corona is basically comprised of fat and carbohydrate.
So some of these rare viruses, and you mentioned human encroachment into habitat, that's my understanding how Ebola infects humans, because it's largely dormant, I suppose. Also, to some extent, spores that cause I'm having a mental block here. What's the spores that cause?
They're viral. You know, they're just viral particles. But
yeah.
But typically, what happens is that there will be a sentinel event. Will have loss of great apes. Many of them have died as a result of exposure to Ebola or to Marburg. Sometimes you have people who go hunting for protein who wind up exposed to these to blood of these animals. That then allows them to become infected. And then as other people have intimate contact with them, by intimate contact I mean, you know, funerals or trying to take care of them in hospitals or clinics, they become infected, and that's the way it spreads. The most dangerous of these viruses, of course, are those that spread via respiratory route, because many people can become inadvertently infected. And we have a number of measures that we use to talk about how infectious an agent is. And the more infectious it is, the more people who can be infected, obviously, the more risk there is, assuming it's a fatal virus. Now, there are many viruses that don't cause fatal illness that spread quite easily, and we're not as worried about those. But in this instance, it turns out that MERS is not easily transmitted from person to person. We think we know why, and it's probably quite similar to what happened in SARS. You know, SARS was not stopped because we developed a vaccine or because we developed drugs. It was stopped because we developed good approaches to containment of the virus, isolating people who we thought were infected, developing diagnostic tests we could identify who they were, and this allowed us then to stop the virus in its tracks. And I predict that the same thing is going to be the case here. The difference is MERS seems to be popping up in many different locations. But again, it's not spreading easily from person to person. And the only people who seem to have been infected have been people who had very close contact with individuals who have disease. And this is because the virus tends to infect the very, very deepest portions of the respiratory tract. It's not infecting the upper airways where it can be coughed up easily and transmitted to other people.
By the way, what I was trying to think of earlier was anthrax spores, or spores from anthrax. The encroachment, the idea that you have to really go to pretty remote places to stir stuff up, don't you, for it to come?
Well, actually, anthrax is not that hard to find. There are a number of nasty things which I'm not going to talk about because I don't want to give people ideas of what they should be going out and trying to harvest. But, there are lots of infectious agents and components of infectious agents that are found readily. But some of the ones I'm talking about, these exotic agents, if you want to use that, you know, some sort of term to describe them that describes how rare they are, like Ebola and Marburg, we wouldn't encounter these unless we went into places where they lurked. And there are other things there that we don't yet know about. I mean, something like 70% of the emerging infectious diseases that we're concerned about originate with animals. They are infections that are found typically in wildlife that move into either domestic animals and from there into people or directly into people. And there are a number of ways in which people are trying to pursue research to identify these agents before they move into the human population, become a risk, so we can readily detect them and respond to them with the appropriate drugs and vaccines. But as I said, with MERS, I think the key here is going to be containment. And we are trying, you know, we're doing it. We've developed a number of diagnostic tests that are now being used by a number of groups around the world every time there's an unexplained respiratory disease. And there are probably half dozen labs now doing this sort of work around the world.
Well, so far, if the ratio of people infected to those who've died is 77 infected and 40 died, that's a pretty high ratio. It's almost
50%. It is a very high ratio, but that figure may be misleading because we don't really know how many people have been infected. All we know at present is the number of people who have been identified as being infected and those people who have died as a result of being infected. If you go back to 1999, when we first began to see, you know, West Nile virus appear in the Northeast, what occurred in that instance was everybody was concerned that there were many, many people who were dying of West Nile virus. But when we went back and looked using an antibody test at the number of people who've been exposed, we learned that only about 1%, not to say that this isn't important if you're in that unlucky 1%, but only about 1% of people who were exposed developed encephalitis, and an even smaller fraction of those died. So until we actually know how many people are exposed, we're not going to have a good handle on that. Now, I suspect, but this is only speculation, that we're not going to see a lot of asymptomatic disease. But again, I don't think there are many people who are going to be susceptible to it. Whenever you're dealing, however, with a new virus, and MERS certainly falls into that category, there's the opportunity for that virus to change, to become capable of transmission, to become capable of causing more severe disease, to spread in host range. So we have to keep a very close eye on it and how it develops, just as we did with SARS, just as we do with flu, just as we do with HIV, with all the infectious agents that worry us.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ian Lipkin, the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience in microbial discovery and outbreak response. He is now working with an international team of scientists to investigate a deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. Now, I mentioned earlier that the ratio of infected to died is 77 infected, 40 of whom have died. Compare that with SARS that you worked on in China. The outbreak in 2003 infected over 8,000 people and killed nearly 800, so considerably lower ratio. I take it what people are concerned about, since the outbreak appears to be largely in Saudi Arabia, is that in October, the annual Hajj, where millions of Muslim pilgrims from around the world come to Saudi Arabia, and that would, of course, be a vector to take this disease back all around the world if by then it's not contained.
This is indeed a risk, and I think you've identified the concern that we have in the world community. But let me make a comparison to SARS because I think that's illuminating. SARS, at least in certain locations, spread very easily from person to person. And there were these individuals we identified, we refer to them as super spreaders, who were capable of transmitting this virus readily to other people. We haven't identified anything similar with respect to MERS. Now, if that were to change, and that's, again, something that we need to watch and to be careful, you know, doesn't develop, the whole picture would change. But I was very much more worried about SARS than I am about MERS, simply because SARS really took off very dramatically in Beijing and in Toronto and in Singapore. And had it appeared in some other cities, we might have had the same sort of risk. And people became infected just walking through, you know, a specific lobby or a floor of a hotel. That's not occurred with MERS. The people who become infected as a result of exposure to other people have been individuals in a hospital sharing a room. And those individuals have been people who, you know, there's been typically something, you know, awry with them. They've had some underlying medical problem.
Well, my understanding is that a lot of the infections were in the dialysis unit and that patients have been infected, and so have health workers. So how often does that happen?
So here's the big risk for health workers, and this is something that that was an issue during SARS as well. When you do what we call aggressive pulmonary toilet, which means you're using a lot of drugs that open airways, and you're using nebulizers that bring up mucus from deep in the lungs of an individual patient. The dose that you might be exposed to is much, much higher than if you're talking about just passing by somebody who's walking or sitting or lying down or what have you in some area. It's very different than what we saw in SARS. I certainly hope we don't get to SARS. That would be a tragic situation. And we are concerned about, you know, any sort of mass migration, any sort of mass gathering such as you talked about, like the Hajj. In the Hajj, you've got 3 million people, right, who are converging in certain holy sites. So it is a concern, but it's not just this year, and it's not just MERS. There's the same concern every year. The WHO now has a center, what's called a collaborating center for mass migrations that's actually headed by the Deputy Minister of Health, Ziad Memish, who's our partner in trying to work on this problem in Saudi Arabia.
Well, the New York Times describes this scene where a team of scientists from the Saudi Ministry of Health and Columbia University, I don't know whether you were among this team, that went to this Saudi village that was abandoned in the southwest. It's apparently had been abandoned for hundreds of years old. It was hundreds of years old and had been abandoned for a long time. And in the inky darkness, they found a small room that had become the roost of about 500 bats. And the scientists had to set up nets and catch them when they flew out at dusk to hunt for insects. It sort of sounds a bit like the beginning of a horror movie.
that was our team.
That was your team. So tell me about it.
What the team? Well, what we do is, because many of it, you know, unfortunately, this is not an area where we've had a lot of experience. So we have to work with, it's not to say a bad thing. We work with local people who know where the bats are found. It's interesting, in some cultures, you ask people, are there any bats? And they'll tell you no. And that's, in fact, what we were told when we initially went to Bisha in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, we have bats everywhere except Antarctica. And you can find them typically in caves or in abandoned buildings because they do like to nest in warm, dark places where they're safe from predators and large fluctuations in temperature. So the bats, and 70% of the bats in the world are insectivorous. The rest are fruit, majority really fruit eating. And based on the sequence analysis, of this MERS coronavirus and other coronaviruses that we and others have studied, it seemed most likely that the bat of interest would be insectivorous bats. What we then did was we went looking for them. And we found, as you say, these abandoned buildings. And what you do is you look for signs of bat guano, which is basically just, you know, bat feces. Because you may be looking there during the day and you may not see them because they're quite well hidden. And then you come back when they become active. There are a number of approaches. You use something called a harp net, which is basically a monofilament line. It looks like a harp, and the bats hit this monofilament line as they try to fly out of the cave, and they flutter down and they get captured in this little tarp where we sample them. And we don't kill bats. Bats are actually very useful animals. They keep insects under control. They're involved in pollination. So I don't want to give anybody the impression that we think the bats are evil. They're not. And then we release them. But in the meantime, we try to capture, we try to figure out whether or not they're infected with any virus that's that's important of interest. So the EcoHealth Alliance people, who really are the best at doing this, this is another group in New York who's our very close partners in these kinds of studies, are very good at doing these sorts of trapping and releasing studies. And we do work with them in Bangladesh and in South America, virtually all over the world. So, yes, it is sort of an eerie thing to be there at night and see all these animals fluttering around.
Well, you don't want to get bitten, though, do you? I mean, isn't that...
No, you don't want to get bitten. But, you know, you're primarily catching these insectivorous bats. These are tiny bats. Yes, you do not want to get bitten. But, you know, we're not going after vampire bats here. And the trick, really, with these microbats, these tiny bats, is to prevent, is not to hurt them. You know, that's clearly something we don't want to do. Now, the other approach we have is just not to sample the living animal at all, but just to collect the feces that the animal discards. So you just place a tarp in the area where you think they will be living, and you come back and you collect these fecal pellets. It's a little bit difficult in a very hot, arid climate, because if they dry out, you may lose your opportunity to recover what you want, which is really the virus nucleic acid, which is what you're going to characterize back in New York. And we people work under very difficult circumstances. I mean, it's very hot, and the gear which we use, because we don't want people inhaling any of these infectious organisms, which could be quite dangerous, are HEPA filtered. They use HEPA filtered air. They're covered, you know, from head to toe, and it's hot and it's uncomfortable. So these are, you know, these people work under very difficult conditions. I only go there for a couple of days, and then I come back to New York, and I focus on the lab part. You know, this is an ongoing process, and it's not just bats that we're surveying. We're actually going out and trying to collect materials from cats and hedgehogs and camels and so on.
Well, you're on the front line. That's obvious, Dr. Ian Lipkin, and that's the whole point, so that it doesn't cross to the wide population. So you've got your finger in the dike there, and it's very important work that you do, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ian Lipkin, who is the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience in microbial discovery and outbreak response. In the 1980s, Dr. Lipkin identified AIDS-associated immunological abnormalities and was the first to use purely molecular methods to identify infectious agents, and implicated West Nile virus as the cause of the encephalitis epidemic in New York in 1999. He assisted the World Health Organization and the People's Republic of China during the 2003 SARS outbreak, and he and his team have discovered or characterized more than 500 infectious agents. He is now working with an international team of scientists to investigate a deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in a minute.